Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. This is Sunday, and we're now exactly four Sundays away from an event that I hope you'll be able to join me at the Saroyan Theater in downtown Fresno. Free admission for the Sounds of Freedom concert on September 14th. I'll be telling you more information about that as we get closer, but right now I just want you to mark that on your calendar. Sunday afternoon, September 14th. Plan to be at the Saroyan Theater to support your veterans. It won't cost you a thing unless you want to donate to the causes that Sounds of Freedom supports. But you'll hear some great music, and hope to see you there. You'll hear some of their music a little later in the program. And you'll also hear all about the service of Bill Bastian. Bill is a longtime Valley resident who served in the 203rd Engineer Combat Battalion during World War II. That's not what he envisioned, though, growing up. He had long thought of being in the service and the different ways that that might happen. And the course looked pretty clear for you as a teenager, didn't it, Bill?
Yeah, when I was young, I went through Cub Scouting, Boy Scouting, and finally Sea Scouting. And as a senior in high school, I had the local congressman gave me an appointment to Annapolis, and I had the high school grades to go. But I failed the medical examination in San Francisco by not having 20/20 vision. So I instead enrolled at the University of California in Berkeley as a freshman in engineering, and there I took engineer ROTC, which was mandatory at that time. And at the end of my freshman year, I went home for the summer, and when I came back for the next semester, Berkeley had become full of people who had moved into the shipyards in Richmond, which were developing, and I was unable to find student housing, at least at the price that I could afford. So I went back home to Sonora and got involved in the logging and shipping of piling to the Richmond shipyards. In the summer of 42, the military called me and sent me to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, where I took basic training for 3 months with the heat and the chiggers. Then I was sent on to...
That sounds delightful. Hey, let me stop you there for a second, Bill, and don't lose that train of thought, but I want to go back to this Annapolis thing. Here you are, a Sonora Wildcat at Sonora High School, which, by the way, in my high school days at Las Banas, my very least favorite high school gym to play basketball in was Sonora High, because the lights were so dark yellow, you felt like you were in the Twilight Zone. But I won't linger there. But here you are, Sonora High School senior. You've got a congressional appointment to Annapolis. You think you're going to be a midshipman in the academy. You're going to be a naval officer. And they tell you your eyes aren't good enough. I want you to tell our listeners what kind of glasses you wear now at 87 years old.
I don't wear glasses at 87 unless I'm in a telephone booth with the light a little dim.
Exactly. My point exactly. So I guess your eyes were all right after all.
Yes.
And the Navy missed out. So you end up instead, as you say, in that engineer ROTC program. I'll let you pick it up where you left off there. I just wanted to illustrate that point, that while the Navy didn't think your eyes were good enough, they've served you pretty well for the last 70 years since then.
Right, and I think at this time I'm glad I didn't go in the Navy. I'd probably be in the deep six out in the middle of the Pacific instead of sitting here where it's comfortable at KMJ.
I took my
engineer basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, volunteered for Officers Candidate School, which then put me into basic training again at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which was deep in the winter. And on January the 3rd, I became an officer and a gentleman. From there, I was in the cadre of this 203rd Engineer Combat Battalion, the same organization that I stayed with till the end of the war. I and a couple of sergeants went to Fort Dix, New Jersey with a requisition for 900 recruits. And we picked up 900 young men and boys from New Jersey and New York, put them on a troop train. They locked the doors and took a circuitous route to Camp McCain, Mississippi. And when they got off of that train, they says, "My Lord, where in the world have we ever ended up?" And there we gave them basic training. That's my third time at basic training.
We had a guest last week, Francis Cowles, who said basic training was the worst part of his war experience. You had to do it three times?
Three times, yeah.
Were you used to it by time number three?
Well, the first two times I was taking the basic training, this third time I was giving it.
Which was, I'm sure, a lot more fun.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
From there, we went on down to Florida and took a training in making beach landings, where about every other night we would go out in small boats and land on a beach at daylight and move cargo up and down into the necessary piles on the beach for a typical type of invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after, on January the 1st, we boarded the British liner Aquitania, no convoy, by ourselves, crossed the North Atlantic, way north, cold, to Scotland, trained down to southern part of England, where we were stationed near Torquay, which is basically England's summer resort location. And there we continued to take training relative to the landings, and we were part of the 6th Engineer Special Brigade, which was the organization that landed on Omaha Beach.
Well, and we're going to get to that, because you were there on June 6, 1944. Those of you in the audience, I'm sure, know that as D-Day, the beginning of the Normandy invasion. Really, a lot of people think the turning point in the entire war, at least the war in Europe. And Bill was there, heard about it beforehand, knew some of the things that were going to happen, but I'm sure was not completely prepared for what he would see on June 6th. We're going to hear all about that. I want to ask you about crossing the Atlantic. Talked to so many young men who have crossed in so many different fashions, on different size ships, with escorts, without escorts, zigzagging, not zigzagging. You said you were all alone, just the Aquitania. Did that make you nervous at all? I'm sure you'd read in the newspaper about these U-boats and the sinkings.
I think that at our age and at that time, we didn't do a lot of thinking about much of anything. The North Atlantic is cold and miserable, and this is a fast ship, and the thing we thought about mostly, not so much me, but my men, I had a stateroom with a marble tub and a marble basin, and shared it with one other officer, and the men were up and down in those bunks, so stacked so tight like sardines that if you wanted to turn over in your cot, you had to get the guy above you to move, because the space between them was less than your hips or your shoulders. And it was a British liner, and of course they, I guess, got paid so much per head, but they didn't have to take very much food, because all of those men were pretty sick for the whole five-day trip.
I imagine so. You did all, your Sea Scout preparation, I'm sure, helped you out there.
It all helped.
And I imagine you probably had more people on that ship than you'd had in the whole town of Sonora.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
By far.
Yeah, by far. The Aquitania was a ship, sister ship with the Mauritania and the Lusitania, which the Lusitania's sinking started World War One. Mm-hmm. So it had been built some time ago, but was doing good service during the war.
So you get across the pond, you arrive in Glasgow in January of 1944, and surely you knew what was going on in Europe. You knew what Hitler had been up to. You'd read the newspapers. When did you get an inkling of how grand of an idea that your unit would be a part of, how significant an operation that you would end up holding a hand in?
Well, the first thing that I think automatically when we went over there, we knew we were going to be involved in the invasion. When we were supplied with equipment, we were doled out equipment on a much grander scale than we had ever had in training or that a normal engineer battalion has. We had 60-foot cranes, very large bulldozers and tractors, all of which we had to find a place and then train the men to operate, because it's beyond the equipment of a normal combat engineer battalion. And amongst other things, there was a training given in waterproofing these vehicles, where we had to do things to them so that they could ride in water as deep as the operator could hold his head up. And we had to take a test insofar as to be sure we knew what we were doing and how we did it. And during this time, we made a practice invasion on the south coast of England at a place called Slapton Sands, where the British government had moved out quite a large area and removed all the people and set up a place for making practice landings. And many of you might realize that during the same time, several German E-boats managed to get in and sink three LSTs on one of these same type of maneuvers. Not ours, but another, and probably was one of the largest number of casualties of the American forces in a single day.
And it was something that at the time nobody heard about, because the government didn't want people to hear about it.
That's right. It was kept, well, we didn't even know about it. That's why I say I don't know. I'd never looked it up to see if it was before or after us, because this was going on with other units all through that time.
And that's another instance where you say, boy, if one thing had worked out a little bit differently, that could have been me. I know there are many more of those to come. We need to catch our first commercial break. Bill Bastian is our guest today. He was there at Omaha Beach, June 6, 1944. When we come back, we'll hear more about the lead-up to the Normandy invasion, the execution of it on June 6, 1944, and the time that followed through the end of the war with Bill Bastian's service during the Army with the 203rd Engineer Combat Battalion during World War II. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Army engineers who get those caissons rolling along, right? That's what I've heard. The tune there performed by the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local military band, which, as I told you, you can hear in concert September 14th at the Soroyan Theater in downtown Fresno. Free admission. More information in the weeks ahead. We're 4 weeks away from that right now. And we're just seconds away from more of Bill Bastian's story. Bill was in the 203rd Engineer Combat Battalion, part of the 6th Engineer Brigade that was practicing for an invasion of Europe. He mentioned that he had spent some time at Slapton Sands. Maybe that rings a bell for you if you've heard about the incident that nobody heard about until years after the war. In late April of 1944, the U.S. was trying to simulate one of the beaches they were hoping to land on what would turn out to be June 6th. Slapton Sands was supposed to resemble Utah Beach, which was one of the code names for the beaches, one of the beaches at Normandy that the U.S. would eventually land on. And they were practicing that landing on Slapton Sands, as Bill had done at one point, when the Germans caught them. There were eight LSTs that were participating in that. Three of them were hit, and by the end of that German ambush, 198 sailors were killed, 551 were injured. So it was a pretty big loss for the United States, but one the U.S. was determined to keep a secret for a long time, not just because it would not be good publicity, but because it might give away this grander plan of what would eventually happen about 5 weeks later. So, Bill, you had been there at Slapton Sands, and while that might have prepared people for landing at Utah Beach, it didn't really prepare you guys much for what you'd encounter at Omaha Beach, right?
Well, the thing was that we didn't know what we were going to encounter at Omaha Beach, and Slapton Sands had a very steep, loose sand type of a beach that was even difficult to walk on, and certainly these 60-foot cranes and great big tractors and things that we had really wouldn't fit. But I don't think that ever entered our heads at this time. After all these years, I can look back, and maybe there was somebody upstream somewhere in this organization that did much better things than many of us would ever believe. I think they knew what they were doing.
Well, and you saw evidence that there was a pretty detailed and meticulous plan that was at play here. You actually, there was a mock-up, right? A mock-up of almost exactly what you would end up encountering at Omaha Beach?
Right. In Torquay, they had taken over a building where the officers were brought in early in the situation to see a mock-up of Omaha Beach. And it was all in scale, would show all of the machine gun emplacements and the big guns and everything else as best they could get them. And if you were allowed in there, you were bigoted. And so anybody that was a bigot had the ability to go back and study the area where he was probably going to land.
And that was just the term they gave to someone who had clearance to be privy to that information.
That's right.
And you were fortunate enough to be one of those guys.
That's correct.
Was that a burden for you? Do you think it maybe affected your outlook knowing this is what we're going to try to do as opposed to someone who's going in there and not knowing?
I still think that when you're 22 years old, you don't have any opinions about any of those things. What are we going to have for breakfast?
And there would be plenty of things that would catch you by surprise once you did get to Omaha Beach.
That's true.
Let's talk about that. What's the first thing you remember on June 6th, 1944? Was it getting up in the morning, looking out, and seeing a ton of ships out on the water? What was it?
Yes, we had arrived there and went as we were moving along. By the time the light came along where we could see, everywhere we looked, there were ships of all sizes and shapes. And when we got off the beach, we just sat there waiting for somebody to decide when we get off and in what priority. And I think that I was lucky in that I didn't go ashore until late in the afternoon. D-Day, you could say, there's two parts to D-Day. There's the morning, and then there's the afternoon. And the afternoon was the part that you would rather be involved in.
Well, the afternoon, you were a lot less likely to get killed.
That's absolutely right. Like the fellow you had last week, he said the worst thing about the war was doing the basic training. The second worst thing about these kinds of landings is getting off of the big ship down the cargo net into the little ship, a little small boat, because that is very, very dangerous. You're loaded up with an awful lot of equipment and weight, and you have to climb down a cargo net. It's pretty difficult.
Well, yeah, if you're doing that on solid ground, it's scary enough. But when you've got the waves bouncing both ships, it could be a little unnerving, I suppose. What was that like for you, and how much were you carrying as you tried to get down that cargo net?
Well, I don't know. I was loaded down quite a bit with an overcoat and my carbine and extra ammunition and some K rations. But again, luck was with me, and I made it.
Well, that's the short version of the story. I'm sure it wasn't a red carpet rolled out from you from the big ship to the little ship, as you say it, to the shore. Were you on an LCVP? How did you get to the beach?
On an LCVP from an LST.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And on the way, I'm sure you saw a few things and heard a few things.
Yeah. There was a lot of noise going on and a lot of damage around, and the Germans were still shooting infrequently from the bluffs up on Omaha Beach.
Is it something where, as you're on your way toward the beach, you see bodies in the water, you see bodies on the beach?
I didn't, no, not at that time of day.
What, tell us about that. When you got to, was that a long trip to the beach? Did it go by quickly?
Well, it's a long trip because the beach at Omaha is very, very flat, and the tidal range is 30 feet. So from high tide to low tide is approximately a half a mile. So at low tide, there'd be a half a mile of beach exposed. We didn't go in at a low tide. We got in pretty good and waded on ashore and found a place to hide.
I mean, were you worried? Were you scared? Did you realize this could be it for me?
I think so. But again, I don't have any memory of paying much attention to that. Just
trying
to do
your job.
Taking care of myself and do my job. At that particular time, I had charge of the people that take care of equipment, and we were not all together as such. And it was the next morning before I got together with my men on the beach, and we had no equipment other than what we had with us at that time. So I put them to work finding vehicles that had been damaged and wouldn't run and abandoned, and seeing what they could do to get them going again. And anything we could get running, we took it to the foot of the road that leads off of the beach. Omaha Beach has two entrances, one opposite Vierville and one opposite St. Lawrence or Mare, and in between maybe 3 or 4 miles of beach where the bluffs were behind you, where the Germans had been shooting from. And so any equipment we could get going, we brought it down there and put it so that anybody that needed it could take it on up. We stayed on the beach until our own equipment came ashore, which was maybe even the next day.
And as it turned out, the makeup of this beach, and you talked about the tide, when you've got a tide that's that significant, you can have stuff where it's floating half the day and it's on solid ground the rest of the day. And I understand that the sand itself was turned out to be a lot easier to deal with for you than your practice sand at Slapton had been.
That's true. The entire operation became almost the equivalent of a commercial operation of a port, in that we could bring ships directly in on a tide, tie them to a tractor so that they wouldn't float away, let the tide go out, and drive vehicles directly out under the ship, and the ship itself unloaded the supplies right into the truck, and the trucks drove on up the beach and out through these exit roads to the quartermaster dumps where they belonged, or later directly on through the Red Ball Express all the way up to the German border.
And for those who aren't familiar with the Red Ball Express, that was a pretty big key to the victory in Europe during World War II. Without it, the victory pretty much would have been impossible. Explain to our listeners quickly, before we catch this next commercial, what the Red Ball Express was and how significant a role Normandy played in that.
Originally, it was intended that the port of Cherbourg would be put into operation to supply the American forces a short time after D-Day, but it turned out that the condition of Cherbourg was such that it was not able to be used, and so Omaha Beach became the total supplier for the American forces clear to the time that we were across into Germany. And the Red Ball Express was set up so that one particular group of French roads went in one direction and then they returned on another, so there was a loop. And several weeks after this had been in operation, one day I had gone somewhere to try to get some parts and material for fixing tires, because with all of the shooting that went on back of Omaha Beach and all of the mud that was caused because the vehicles would be off-road and on-road and it rains frequently, it was very, very muddy. And so in no time at all, tire repairs and tubes were one of the major necessities for us. And so one day I with a Jeep driver, went off, and I can't remember the name of the place where there was a quartermaster organization where I thought I could get some supplies. And coming back, we decided, well, we don't want to take a certain road because that's the Red Ball Express and we don't want to get involved with them, so we'll take one of these small little farm roads or country roads back. And partway back, all of a sudden, about 20 or 30 feet behind us, the whole road blows up.
And hello.
Apparently, it was a time-delayed mine that the Germans had laid, and of course, we just kept right on going.
And they put those time-delayed mines because they figure most times people are traveling, they're not going to be traveling in just one Jeep like you were. They'll be in a long procession, a column, and if it's time-delayed, the front of the column is going to trigger it. It's going to explode and blow someone else behind them.
Right.
So you, that was another pretty close call for you.
Well, yeah, but there's the luck of the draw.
And it was on your side there, and you talk about all the flat tires. I guess the Red Ball Express wouldn't have been much of an express if everybody's tires were flat.
Well, I would like to say that all of the troops, besides all of the equipment for the Americans, for the Army, all of the people came across Omaha Beach day after day, week after week, and they always spent one night back of the beach bivouacking to collect their equipment and get organized, and then they would move on. And most nights, something would fly over, whether it be a single German plane or maybe even one of our own, I don't know. But it didn't take very much to get every one of these guys that had just arrived to shoot at it. And so
I know there's a good ending to that story coming up, but unfortunately I'm going to have to let our listeners wait a second to hear it. We need to get in another commercial here, but when we come back, we'll hear about all those guys shooting at the planes coming over and Bill's solution for making sure he didn't get hit by any of that gunfire. Bill Bastian, our guest today, will be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at KMJ580.com. On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I know an itty, nutty as a fruitcake, goofy as a goon,
and silly as a loon. Some call it pretty,
others call it crazy,
but they all sing this tune. Mersey-dotes and dozy-dotes and little lambsy-divey, a kiddly-divey-doo wouldn't do.
Do you have any idea what they're talking about? Well, depending on how old you are, you just might. Bill Bastian remembers that song, Mersey Dotes by the Mary Max, because he actually heard it on his way to D-Day. You heard that? What was the name of the town in Wales?
Abergravenny in Wales. There were so many troops to load to go to D-Day that they all couldn't leave from the south coast of England. And so we were in what was known as the Bristol Channel Preload. We went up north into Wales, and we stayed a couple of nights in this little village of Abergravenny and went to a local dance where I first heard that song. Then we went down to Cardiff and loaded on the LSTs and went out into the Irish Sea, and we were well ahead of what turned out to be D-Day because we had to make a longer trip from the Irish Sea, and at the time we boarded, D-Day was intended to be June the 5th. And so we were out in the sea when the change was made because of weather, and so we had to cruise around and have a little summer vacation, I guess you would call it, somewhere between Omaha and Ireland before we met up with the proper sequence of where our vessel belonged.
And we were talking before the commercial break. I think that was a nice little excursion there to reminisce about the first time you heard that song. Glad to be able to play it again for you. You were talking about being on Omaha Beach, and you assisted with the landing that first afternoon, June 6th. You talked about trying to fix up some vehicles that had been abandoned. You spent a lot of time fixing tires, trying to find tires and tubes. But you were there for quite a while, and every day more troops are coming in because that's where they had to land, and they would stay there for a day and move on. You told us that every night planes would come over, and invariably these troops that are there for the first night are firing at these airplanes. Now, I imagine when you're firing straight up into the sky, that's a lot of lead that's coming back down.
That's exactly right. We happened to be bivouacked all through this time in an apple orchard, and by the end of the summer, there were no leaves on any apple tree in the whole orchard.
That's a hail of gunfire for
you. And with all of this mud and rain, the vehicles on and off from unpaved roads, then all this small pieces of metal that had fallen from these shells, that was really a big part of the cause of the tire trouble.
I imagine so. So that, boy, if you could have just told those guys, hey,
yeah,
chill out, hold your fire. And you actually, and you're very handy, and your friends who play golf with you up at Yosemite Lakes Park know how you can fix anything, and you don't give up on anything, and you're the master of finding the lost balls in the ponds up there at YLP. You had a pretty ingenious idea then, too, didn't you, to make sure that you never fell victim to that lead falling from the sky?
Yeah, knowing that we were going to be there for quite a long period of time, I scrounged stuff around into where I could build myself a little shack where the four of us, I had a warrant officer, a master sergeant, and a staff sergeant, and we were pretty well protected in a small building where we could sleep rather than staying in a foxhole month after month. And when we built this, we also had a false floor that we could take up where we could hide stuff. And having a certain amount of control over all of this equipment that was coming ashore, I had some drivers that knew that if they had fruit cocktail or canned peaches or something like that, it would be nice to stop by Bill and see how things were going. And my staff sergeant, John Cotta from New Jersey, was proficient in French, and in no time at all he had gotten acquainted with a French milkmaid who could fix him up with top cream. And so after our K rations, we frequently had pretty good dessert.
Well, that sounded like the place to be, and certainly the roof protected you from that gunfire you knew would be coming every night about the same time. Did you realize, I talked to a lot of veterans who were involved in something that we can look back now with a historic eye and say, that was really significant. That was an event of great magnitude that really was a deciding factor in the outcome of the war. Did you realize in June of 1944 how big of a deal D-Day would be in history and how significant that operation was that day? You were involved in it. Sometimes it's hard to see when you're that close. Did you know how big a deal that was going to be?
Well, I knew it was important, but I had no conception of the immense size of it or the number of ships or the number of people or anything like that. And back then, you know, we did not have transistor radios, and military communications were not very good, and news was scarce. We didn't know really where anybody was if they were out of earshot for a long time. We didn't know what the progress of the war was back of the beach.
Did you were there for quite a while. Did you ever think, am I going to be here at Omaha Beach for the rest of the war? That thought ever cross your mind?
Well, our primary function was supplying the troops, and as long as they hadn't opened a port, we had to stay there. I think we closed the beach late in October, and we were moved over to the coast of France that's opposite the Guernsey and Jersey Islands, where there were still a number of German troops, and there was a possibility that they would make forays ashore because they didn't have any supplies or food and had been left in limbo there. And we stayed there until just before the bulge started. We arrived in Belgium on the day before Christmas, and the bulge was started about then.
December 16th, 1944 was the first day. And so you got a little taste of that, which I'm sure was a little different weather than you had been used to as a California kid. Was that an adjustment for you? Did that get your attention?
Well, no. Remember, we took basic trading both in Missouri, where it was chiggers and heat, and in Virginia, where it's ice and snow.
You can't say they didn't prepare you.
Yeah, absolutely. They knew what they were doing all the way.
And you also spent some time, as so many engineers in Europe did, dealing with bridges. And that's something, you know, I think kids growing up today, bridges are everywhere. If there's a river, there's a bridge. But at this time, when you're trying to get one place and there's someone trying to stop you, bridges became perhaps one of the most strategic things in the war.
That's true. A battalion of engineers has three companies, A, B, and C, and then the headquarters company. And I always happen to be assigned to headquarters company in one position or another. So I was not necessarily involved in their line work, but they were continually, rather than fixing tires and making the machinery run like I was, they were either doing road work, crushing rock, gravel, fixing roads, or tearing down bridges or building bridges. And I got involved in one major bridge on the Fulda River, which is between Frankfurt and Kassel, that was a major bridge construction job for wartime engineers. It was a two-lane wide bridge built on a destroyed portion of the Autobahn across this Fulda River. And it was a bridge that required concrete work, timber work, and steel work.
And once that bridge was finished, you guys ended up dedicating it to a guy that a lot of people were familiar with his name, a gentleman who certainly is one of the people we look up to in the journalism field as a trailblazer and a guy that we can be proud of, and a guy who was killed in the line of that work, Ernie Pyle.
That's right. It's the Ernie Pyle Bridge.
Did you guys know who he was? Did that mean something to you?
Oh, yeah, we all did, because we knew him from way back all along.
Is that bridge still there?
Oh, I would doubt it.
A lot of these bridges were just temporary and just there to get you where you needed to go at the time, but it still had some significance to be able to honor people with those names, right?
Well, especially for the Army to be building a bridge that was two-lane wide and 500 or 600 feet long, multi-spans, with timber bents and steel I-beam, scrounge material from everywhere. There was no German lumber to go get. We took over sawmills and cut the timbers and brought them to the sawmill and had them cut and did the whole job with our own forces and some civilians.
Is that the kind of thing where when you are done and you finally put that finishing touch on the bridge, there's a big cheer that goes up and you celebrate a little bit because you have something to really be proud of?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Well, we need to catch our final commercial break of this program today. We'll still have a few minutes left when we come back with Bill Bastian, served with the Army, the Engineers in World War II. And he wasn't just at Normandy on June 6, 1944. He had a chance many decades later to return there. And we'll ask him about that and the rest of his experiences during World War II when Hometown Heroes continues here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Still have a few minutes left here on Hometown Heroes today. There's never enough time to get all the stories that each one of these Valley veterans of World War II has inside that brain. And Bill Bastian's brain is a highly functioning brain. He's got a ton of memories stored in there. And Bill, I understand for a while you had a nightly task that doesn't sound like much fun to me. Anytime you have to go somewhere in hostile territory by yourself, it doesn't sound like fun. But I understand that just you and your driver, one Jeep, had to go back and forth through a really contested forest where you smelled and saw and heard just about everything you could imagine?
That's right. I was the communications liaison officer between the higher headquarters and our battalion commander, and we had to make this trip to their staff meeting, which was usually about dinner time, and then so after that, it was dark when we came back, and we were traveling through the German forest where there were burning tanks and trucks tipped over, because this was an area that had just been taken by our forces. And it was during the period of time when apparently it was a good thing for the Germans to put a cable across the road, and it stops the Jeep in a hurry. And everybody had gone ahead and built barriers on the fronts of their vehicles with a welder welding angle iron up there to try to protect them. And it's very, very scary to be traveling by yourself down through this part of the country. And so I sat with a Tommy gun on my lap, and we just managed to make it each time without any bad incidents, but we had real serious feelings about it.
I can, man, I'm getting nervous just hearing you talk about it, and I wasn't anywhere near there. You had a chance, as we enter the final minutes of the show here, you talked about being on Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. You had a chance, a half century later, to go back there. In fact, you were there with KMJ's own Ray Appleton when he took a delegation of folks from around here there, and you ended up acting as a tour guide for many of them. But what was that like for you personally to be back there after all these years of history had told you how important the thing that you were a part of was?
Well, it was a wonderful trip for me, and it's probably one of the biggest events of my life to be able to go back to all of these places and, looking ahead on the bus, know what was going to be around the next turn or what was going to be in the next village that we came to, and be able to sit there and talk to the people that were on the tour who had never been over, even maybe many of them in Europe at all. And it just made the trip very, very good to me, and I think Ray enjoyed it too. After we came back, Ray had me on his show here too with several of the other fellows that had been on the trip.
Oh, I'm sure he enjoyed it very much. But I'm sure for you, as enjoyable as it was, there had to be some emotional moments. And I imagine, I've heard a lot of veterans talk about one spot in particular there that kind of takes their breath away.
Yeah, the initially, all of the people that were killed on Omaha Beach were temporarily buried with our bulldozers in an area behind the beach, and later they were moved to a cemetery that's there now. And part of Ray's tour, we went to that cemetery, and it gets to you. It's a real, real, real beautiful thing to stand there and cry about this. That's the way it is.
If you aren't familiar with what the price of freedom is before you go there, I'm sure you are afterwards. And I imagine for you, having taken part in burying those bodies in the sand initially there, that seemed like a much more fitting and honorable resting place for those brave young men.
That's true. Yeah. It's a wonderful place.
Well, I'm glad that you got a chance to go back there. You ready to go back again? Can I go with you?
Anytime.
And I believe it. We'll make the plans. We'll figure that out. We've got about a minute and a half left here in the show, Bill. You don't act your age, and so many of the people on our show don't. You act a lot younger than you actually are. I'm sure you come in contact, especially out there on the golf course where you spend so much time, with people of my generation and younger. If there's one thing that you would have people understand about World War II, what was at stake, what was the significance of what you and people like you did, what would that one thing be?
I think Americans in general, and take this case in point, the 900 recruits from Fort Dix, New Jersey, didn't know how to shift gears or drive a vehicle. They'd never been anything but a subway, and didn't know a hammer from an axe or a screwdriver. And we took them to Mississippi and made engineers out of them, where they were using chainsaws and building bridges and doing all of the things that engineers do besides soldiering. And then we take them over there to Europe and show them a crane that's with a 60-foot boom or a D7 or a D8 cat, And first thing you know, they're operating it and unloading cargo on Omaha Beach. I mean, that's what Americans are. They're people that can look at the job and figure out how to get it done. And one way or another, they do the job.
Well, and you did your job. We thank you for your service to our country and for being here today. Bill Bastian, our guest today, will be back with another edition of Hometown Heroes next Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ.